You're listening to Angela and Friends, the podcast on the Psychic Choice Radio Network. Welcome back. You're listening to Psychic Choice Radio 1, Angela and Friends, the podcast. And if you can hear some little birdies tweeting around in the background, that's because I've got my guest with me today, the wonderful Mr. Freddie Valentine. How are you, Freddie?
I'm fantastic, thank you very much. How are you today? Are you okay?
I'm doing great. And we're just going to have a little chat and see where it goes. So tell the listeners a bit about yourself and what it is you do.
Yeah, my little Frank might join in the chat, by the way. Frank, the buddy, is very talkative. He sings a lot. I've got two buddies, but he's the chatty one, Frank. He's probably joining in. He might be saying something deep. But I'm Freddie. I work as a psychic and a paranormal investigator. That's what I mainly do. I investigate all sorts of strange and unusual things. I also collect weird haunted objects as well, antiques that have got stories behind them. And I exhibit those. And I'm also work in show business. You know, I have a cabaret act and I have a recording project. It's like a band, but we don't do anything live. It's very studio-based and very psychedelic, I suppose you could say. So I'm interested in lots of different things. I did a podcast for a while called The Mystic Menagerie, which is still on iTunes, and we covered all sorts of paranormal stuff, including some very weird and wonderful stories. We looked for the weirdest things we could and the unusual guests on there and very interesting people. So I'm very interested in all the unusual side of life, you know. I'm quite interested in Victorian history and that kind of stuff as well. So the odd and the bizarre interest me greatly.
Cool, that's amazing. I mean, the odder the better, really, isn't it? You know,
definitely, yeah.
When it comes to the paranormal world, many, many things have occurred, and I'm sure that you've got many stories to tell. And the fact that you're saying about you're interested in, like, the Victorian side of things as well, my husband's going to love this podcast, you know, because he's really into his history, so I know you're going to get one fan. Tell us some stories then, Freddie, because I'm dying to hear them.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the things investigated. I mean, some unusual stuff's happened. I run events, like paranormal events. We go to an old building or in an area, you know, which has got a lot of history to it, and we do seances and stuff like that there. We've had some really weird stuff happen. One of them, it was based near Windsor, you know, which is a very old town. As you know, the Windsor Castle there, the Queen, there's a lot of history attached to it. And the building we was doing it in, there's a river at the back, River Thames, and it's quite known. It's been there for years, you know, this part of the river. A lot of suicides and things up there, and there's been a disaster where a boat sunk in the 1700s, I think. When we did a ghost walk there, it was in broad daylight. It was as light as it is. I mean, now it's quite light. The sun's out. We did a ghost walk in the daylight. And there was 20 people on the walk with us, and there was a daylight apparition there. And 17 people out of the 20 saw this. And what it was like a woman in Victorian clothing, like pulling a baby out of the water, and then sort of like going backwards and forth, like a loop, like a video being played, you know, like a loop being frozen. Yeah. But there's three people out of the 20 that said, I can't see anything. But 17 people said, is it someone dressed up? Or is it some event going on at the castle and they're dressed up in Victorian clothes? Or something like, you know, there's something like that. But we went over to it, we actually walked closer and closer. It sort of like flickered. I'll tell you what it looked like. You know, in Star Wars, when they project the hologram of Princess Leia saying, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, it's that kind of flickery thing to it, and it just disappeared. That was a very bizarre experience. But the most horrific, when I was younger, I did a lot of urban exploration, which is where you find a very old building, and you break into it, it's not legal to do that, or you're not supposed to do it, and have a look around. And we used to break into these buildings, like very old, like asylums and stuff like that, and do seances there, take a Ouija board in, and stuff like that. And one of them, there's two very interesting stories. One of them we went to is an abandoned hospital. It's like a normal, it was a maternity hospital where they'd have other stuff there as well. You know, there's like an A&E there as well. It's called the Canadian Red Cross Hospital. It was in Taplow, which is quite near Clifton. Do you know where Clifton is? It's like an old house.
Grounds there.
It's quite famous, Clifton, because in the 60s there was the Christine Keeler, the film Scandal. There was the Christine Keeler thing that went on there. So it's quite an old area, old buildings and that. But this hospital had been abandoned for quite a while. So it's in the middle of, imagine it's woodland there. Nothing there, very dark, no street lights, and there's this creepy old hospital there, and it's all boarded up. So me and my friend went in there one night, and it was so creepy as anything. We walked around there, we walked around the back. The mortuary was out the back. It's a big grass bin. There's a mortuary there. Looked around it, and it was very, very, the vibe there was very strong. You felt a presence there, that you're being watched by spirits. You know, you felt that something was watching you. When we went to one room there, there was all witchcraft stuff there. There was all pentagrams on the wall. There's been rituals there. There's been things burnt inside that room. And there'd been like small, not voodoo dolls, like effigies, like corn dollies on the ground.
Wow.
And I said to my friend, this is really strange why this is in this room. Why none of the other rooms or another part of the building this is there, but there's all this graffiti on the wall and things that are written there. Do you know what I mean? There was things written in Latin and pentagrams. When I did some research, what it turned out was there was a coven in the 60s called the Clan of Tubal Cain. It's run by a bloke called Robert Cochrane, and they used to meet in the woodland nearby called Burnham Beaches, very ancient woodland. And this guy, one day on Midsummer's Eve, I think 1966, he took a chalice of poison wine to one of his ceremonies and drank this poison wine because he wanted to give a sacrifice on Midsummer's Eve, and he said the biggest sacrifice would be himself. And he collapsed there, and he was taken to this hospital, and that's the room that he died in. So it became like a shrine to him.
My goodness.
So that was quite an intense feeling. The other thing was we got into an asylum once. It's called Cane Hill, which is up near Croydon. And it's quite a well-known, it's a Victorian asylum where they do all sorts of, you know, the old lobotomies and everything in there. So a lot of suffering had happened in this building. But when we're in there, it's so intense. I mean, there's famous people been there. I mean, Michael Caine's mother was in there, and David Bowie's brother was in there. And there's a lot of suicides there because people would go out, they climb out, go down this railway track down the bottom and lie on the rails and that. But when we're in there, I got a feeling of someone choking me.
Oh, gosh.
Like two hands around my throat. And we kept hearing these, like, footsteps around. It's really intense in there. It felt like there was people there. We went to one room. There's one room. There's, like, a key in the door. It's, like, locked, but it's a rusty key in the door. And my friend put his hand on this door, and he got, like, a jolt through him, like he was getting shocked.
Yeah.
And when we opened the door, looked inside it, it was the old electric shock treatment room.
Oh, my goodness me.
And so I actually took the key and kept it, and it's part of my strange museum of objects I've got. You know, I've got things in there, like shrunken heads and mummified witch body parts and that kind of stuff, and old witchcraft books from like the 30s and stuff like that. So I've got this really old weird stuff that I've got that I keep. So that's in the collection now. But yeah, that was a very intense experience. So sometimes these buildings, because there's so much history in there, you know, it retains a lot of what happened in it, I feel.
Yeah, a lot of residual energy. And what about holding on to those items? Do you feel like you've maybe brought any entities or energies back with you?
We always try to cleanse them, but I keep them in certain... I keep them in very protected big boxes, you know, like very solid boxes, so they're thick, you know, so it almost keeps the energy within that box. So when I don't exhibit them or look at them, I'm keeping them very much locked away. I don't sort of keep them on the mantelpiece or anything like that, because it would scare visitors anyway, for a start.
I can imagine,
Someone come around to fix your heating and there's a shrunken head on the mantelpiece, they'd probably run a mile. But yeah, no, I keep them in sort of like museum... quality boxes, you know, when they're locked away and stuff like that. But there's definitely vibes to them, because when I've done my events, I do some psychometry, and some of the events, the objects that aren't distinguishable, I give it to people, put it in their hand and say, what can you pick up about this, you know, and with the psychometry, as you get some strange reactions, and people do tend to pick up where they're from or something about it.
Yeah.
So when they hold the key, they said it feels like a tingling in my hand or shock or it's burning, you know, and stuff like that. So you get very odd reactions to stuff like that. I mean, psychometry can be quite a powerful thing, particularly when you've got objects like that that's got a lot of history attached to it, or something negative behind it, or something intense, and to see whether people pick up that intensity. You know, if someone picked up that key and said, no, I feel very happy, so I married a couple of cows, then they're completely off the mark. But a lot of people hold that and they say they feel a very intense feeling, or like a tingly feeling in their hands. So it's really interesting doing that stuff like that. And I like using old objects and things of history to them. It fascinates me. They're like haunted objects, haunted antiques, I suppose you could say.
Yeah. Do you have any haunted dolls or anything like that? I've always been fascinated with the haunted dolls. I don't actually like having dolls in my house, to be honest with you, but yeah, that's probably why.
Yeah, they are quite creepy. I mean, the one haunted doll I've got, it's not actually, you know, they're usually like porcelain sort of made dolls, you know, the sort of dolls like that, Annabelle, they're usually like that, aren't they?
Mm.
The one I've got is actually it's a rag doll, but it's a Victorian one, again, but it's from a poor child, a very poor child. So it's almost like it's been handmade by their parents for the child. So what it's basically is, it looks like a Raggedy Ann doll, but what they've done is they've got like cloth, or it's like lace, you know, Victorian, you know, the clothing was very much a sort of thick stuff with lace on the end of it. They've got a bit of that, twisted around to make a head, and then put arms on it, and they're drawn with a pen or pencil on the face on it, so it's drawn onto it. So it's not like a properly made one shot. It's one that some poor family had made for their kids. And somebody found this, you know, and gave it to me. Because a lot of friends know I collect stuff like this. So they see something weird or find something unusual, they tend to say, oh, I know who like that, you know. So I've got friends that are builders and they renovate old buildings. So they find, like, there's one house, a cottage they was renovating. It was down in Norfolk, I think it was. And then there's a hole in the wall. When they sort of looked in this, there's like bricks in front of this hole. They took these bricks out, looked in, there's like an alcove in there. And inside was a witch bottle. Things like that, you know, which is obviously this house is like, you know, about 500 or 600 years old. Had witch bottles and stuff like that in there, so they gave me things like that. So this old doll was a Victorian, it would have been a poor child that would have had it, but it's got a sad feeling to it. I wouldn't say it's got a horrible feeling or an intense feeling, but when you hold it, it's very sad, the feeling that's attached to it.
Oh, Wow. Gosh. So you have got quite a collection going on there. So do you kind of like take them on tour and kind of display them? Is that how you go about, you know, getting other people to view them, so to speak?
Yeah, what I tend to do is, I mean, I do different things. There's sometimes like local art carnivals, you know, these sort of like fakes and stuff like that, and I have a tent, and people can pay and come and look at them. You know, they're set out on a table and I talk about them and stuff like that. We've had problems with that before because you get some, we have warnings and saying over 18s only and warning of the content. We had one woman was very upset and said to this government official, oh, he's exhibiting human remains in there. Do you know what I mean? And this, we got investigated, but apparently if someone's died over 100 years ago, it's legal to exhibit human remains. That's mummified, you know. But if they've died within 100 years, then it's illegal to get a special license to do it. But the stuff I've got is so old that it was okay, you know. So I do have those sort of fakes I do sometimes. And people hire me sometimes, like if they're having like a party or an event, I turn up with my exhibits and I give a talk about each one and people can see them or take pictures of them and stuff like that. People like to take photographs of them because they've not seen anything like it. And also I do things where, so like a hall and they have like a thing on there. Sometimes I have a few bits on display there and people have a look at them. So yeah, it's people do have an interest in stuff like that. People do like the macabre, you know, and it turns the stomach of some people, but people are generally interested in it. I think with shrunken heads, you don't get to see them very often. I think the Welcome collection in London's got some shrunken heads, and so is the Ripley's, believe it or not. But when they see one as close up as I've got one, it's quite astonishing. I did a seance once in a wine bar, would you believe?
Wow.
And what I did is an evening, it's like an evening of a psychic evening, really. And what I did is we started out with doing psychic testing with the people that were there, with Zener cards and whatever, you know, and doing some psychometry. And then we went to do Ouija board sessions. And then at the end, I talked about the paranormal and unusual things and exhibited some of the objects. And I brought one of the shrunken heads there. And about half an hour, that shrunken head, people were come taking pictures of it, asking questions about it. And it's amazing. And one woman said that she was quite an old lady, said that her gran used to have one. And she used to hang it from the door, like hanging from like a door handle.
Oh my goodness.
It's a real shrunken head. But they're hard to find these days, you know. But yeah, people are fascinated by that sort of stuff, you know, as I am, you know. But I suppose as you've seen it a lot, I've got one, like, you kind of get used to it, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I've always had a fascination for like horror films and, as you said, the macabre myself.
Yeah.
So yes, I do find this really kind of fascinating. And people sort of look at me and go, would you look so innocent? Oh dear. Anyway,
it is fascinating. I mean, I grew up in the 70s, and the thing is, the paranormal was quite a big thing then. Nowadays, it's not so, like, for kids, there's not so much. There's more technology is what kids are interested in, science and all that. But when I was a kid, you had the Hammer horror films. There was programs on telly about ghosts. And these books came out. There was ones that were called the Usborne books of vampires. There's a book of ghosts. And when they were put in the bookshop with the normal other kids' books, you know, so there'd be books about dinosaurs and Vikings and then about vampires. So as a kid, I thought, well, it must be real. Because it's put in with the other stuff.
Mm.
And the way it was written is, you have to say, it wasn't written as a speculation, it's saying this is fact, you know. I remember that's where I first heard about the Bawley Rectory and things like that. It's in this book, The Usborne Book of Ghosts. And it's like drawings in it, very nice drawings, no photographs, all drawings inside it, you know, very nice drawings. And these true life stories about ghost encounters and stuff like that. So that was very big. And there's a magazine called The Unexplained, one of these part work ones, you know, you buy them every week or whatever. And that covered all sorts of stuff. It had amazing photographs in it, it had Roswell crash and stuff. At the time, people hadn't really heard much about that sort of thing in the 70s. But in this magazine, it's full of really good photographs, and it had about EVP in there, spontaneous human combustion, and it covered everything, you know. So reading this magazine, and again, it's presented as factual rather than speculation. So a lot of kids grew up in the 70s watching these horror things on television, you know, like these Tales Unexpected and Hammer films, and reading these sort of magazines. So it became a bit of an instilled belief in you. The other two things that are very important is, when I was a kid, I went to the Witchcraft Museum in Boscastle in Cornwall, and at the time that was called the Witch's House. And when I went in there, that kind of blew my mind as a young kid, you know what I mean, about 6 years old, and seeing all these witchcraft objects.
Yeah.
And at the time, they had a skeleton of a witch in there, in a coffin. As you went out, it's like an actual real skeleton of this witch who was hung. But since then, what they've done, I think they've been a campaign to get her a proper burial, and they've buried the remains, the skeleton. But I remember, as you go out the door, it's like a little corridor you walk down, this coffin at the end, it's open with this skeleton in it, you know, so this is a witch who was executed. So that sort of stuff, if you sit at a young age, it's going to stick with you, you know. And there's also that kind of thing, as you get older, you think, well, I want to find out if it's real, experience it, you know. I want to keep my mind very open to it, you know. So I thought I think people of a certain age tend to be more focused towards this than the generation we've got now, I think.
Yeah, they're very kind of cushioned from it. And I'm more 80s, but I remember very much been fascinated by the PG Tips Unexplained Mysteries of the World book, where you had to collect all the little cards, and they had the Cottington Fairies, the Crystal yes. Skulls. Yeah, love that. And that's how I got into it, you know, more Ooh. And more. So I had the Enfield Hauntings on there and everything.
It was that's just, it. Yeah. funny you should mention them cards, because when I did my podcast, Dan, who the other chap I do the podcast with, he had a complete set of those cards.
Oh, wow.
And a feature on the show, we had this guy on here called Nathan, and he was basically, he knew everything about paranormal. If you said a subject, like you could say Bermuda Triangle, he could talk for half an hour on it. There's nothing, he would never say, oh, I don't know about that. He knew everything about the paranormal. What we did this game where we called him the Psychic Oracle. Or Fortune Oracle, sorry. And we get those cards and we say randomly pick a number between, you know, one of, there's 49 cards, I think, one of 49. You say like 25. Right, okay. Levitation, you've got to talk about that. And it's like a comedy show, you know, just a minute.
Yeah.
But rather than just, and the subject you had to talk about was one of those subjects on the cards. So, you know, we'd randomly pick a card and he'd have to talk about it every 10 minutes.
Oh, that's
And he never
really
lets
good.
Down. So yeah. It was good, yeah. But they're great cars, they were, weren't they, in the old tea bags?
Yeah, yeah. Really fascinating, like the hands coming through the wall around the guy that sat on the bench and, oh my gosh,
yeah.
You know.
We covered that one on the show, actually, that actual card, yeah, that did come up.
Wow.
That one, yeah. So there you go. That's a coincidence, isn't it? But yeah. It's all on iTunes if people want to hear that, but that's on there, yeah. So, but it's a fascinating subject. And I think a lot of people are interested or have some belief in the paranormal, but they're scared to express it publicly because of ridicule.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I know a lot of people that are people that wouldn't talk to their friends about it, but when they come to my events, they say, well, actually, I wouldn't tell anyone, but I've seen a ghost before, or this has happened to me, or I've seen a UFO. And they feel they can talk about it to me because I'm not going to judge them. You know, I'm open minded. I'm going to judge them. I'm going to say, okay, yeah, I'll listen to you. I'm not going to give any criticism. I'm very open minded about it. But whereas there are people that might ridicule them, then they're less likely to say about it, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
But I think most people have some kind of experience, you know?
Yeah. Have you had any contact with, you know, alien life forms at all?
Not as contact as such, but I did have a really weird UFO experience once, because I used to go, we used to go out drinking with a couple of friends of mine, but where my mate lived, there was a pub on a main road, and there's like a massive field full of cows and stuff like this. And we walked through this big field, and we got to the other side of this farm. My mate lived up the top of the hill. And there was a friend of ours, and me and my mate, we believed in UFOs. We were very open-minded about it. We believed in that. But some friend of mine said, I don't believe in it. It's a load of rubbish, blah, 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 blah. We was walking across this field one night, and it was a very silent summer night. The sky was very clear, and there was this triangular-shaped object, and it was hovering very low, but it was still in the sky. It wasn't making a plane sound. It was like a weird sort of hum, like a sort of sound. Okay. And it was fairly low. Mm. And it had three lights on the bottom, like one at the top and then two at the bottom, like a triangular shape. But what it was doing, it was staying perfectly still, like a plane doesn't do that, but it was moving around, almost like it's looking around. Mm. And the weird thing was, there was like a field next to us. There was like a fence, like a wooden fence. And on the other side of this field, there was like sparks on the ground. You know, like when you got a lighter and the fence went out, and you keep doing it, sparks come out.
Yeah.
It's like that, but it's all come out of the grass, these sparks. And my friend who didn't believe in them said, oh, I'm freaked out by this. I said, well, you know, it's good. You know, you say you don't believe in them. What's that then? It's probably a plane. I said, look, a plane doesn't stay still like that, you know. And I said, he goes, what are them sparks? I said, well, go and have a look. And he climbed over the field, stood where these sparks were. And as he put his foot down, they stopped.
Oh, my God.
When he lifted his foot up, they started again. And I said, it's really weird. But this friend of mine started getting very scared. And he goes, well, what if it lands? What if it lands? So what if it lands? We'd go on it. It'd be great. We'd meet aliens. Fantastic. I'm up for that. And he's going, no, I don't. I don't want to. I said, we don't believe in them. You know, he goes, well, now after seeing this, he goes, I think it's changed my mind. But what it did after a while, we stayed there for ages. And this friend of mine was getting more agitated by it and scared. But what it is, it's weird. It almost like folded in on itself. Like the front bit closed down. And it closed down like a ball and then shot off like a shooting star.
Wow, oh my God.
It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. But a friend of mine has seen the same kind of thing as well. You know?
Yeah, it's funny you should mention about the triangle and the position of the lights on the craft. Because I actually had a dream that it was a similar craft in my dream. So you're telling me this and I'm sat here going, oh my gosh. It's just like really freaky. But I've never actually seen one in person, you know, that I'm consciously aware of, let's put it that way, but subconsciously things have come in, you know. So yeah, absolutely believe that there is a lot more going on than, you know.
Oh, definitely. I've had a lot of events like that, you know. That was one of the weirdest ones. It's such an eerie feeling, you know. It made such a weird hum sound, you know, and the fact that it wasn't like a plane can't stay still in the sky and just stop.
No.
And this was just still. It's just like it was just there, like it's parked, you know, and it's moving around. It's so odd. You know, but I've had other experiences. Around the same area, I had an apparition go right through me.
Oh, wow.
Actually come through me, because what it was, there was a, it's like an alleyway, like a long alleyway. It's like you have to walk down it single file, and it's all trees and hedges down there. Yeah. And at the end of it is a little village, and you can go into this pub there. So there's a big field, and you walk through this alleyway, and you get into this nice little pub. I was going on, it was a summer's night, and I was walking down with my friend, and we saw this like someone running towards us, dressed like, you know, like Guy Fawkes with a big hat, you know, them big hats and long coats.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And someone dressed up like that, and we thought, that's a bit weird, what's he dressed like for? And it looked like a person, he was running, you know. My mate said, look at his feet. And I looked down, and there was no feet there, like, it was almost like cloud, like Ooh. Misty. So he had no feet, but it was almost like, so he's moving, just moving along, but with no feet, and his arms moving, and his head, was sort of bowed. And as it came towards us, you know, sort of place you have to go through a single file, my mate jumped out of the way to let it pass. But I just stood there, a bit astonished by this, really, and it came right to my face and went right through me. But what it felt like is, imagine if someone had chilled your blood for a second and it had gone ice cold.
Ooh.
And this is a hot summer's night, and I was cold inside, you know what I mean? It was so strange. So we went to this pub, and I was a bit stunned by it, you know. I was quite young at the time. My mate is an artist. He always carries a notepad with him, and I said to him, look, I saw something then. Did you see it? He goes, yeah. I said, well, look, give me your pad. I'll draw it, right, and then you draw it on another page, and we just make sure we saw the same thing, because I don't want someone to agree with each other, you know. So he drew it, and I drew it, and what we saw was exactly the same, you know. And this guy come over, he said, oh, you seen the ghost in here? I said, oh, yeah, there's a bloke in the pub. I said, he goes, yeah, it's always down there. It's like every night at the same sort of time, it just runs down there, and that's all it does. It's like a loop that goes around there. And he said that when he takes his dog out for a walk, the dog won't go down that path. It digs its heels in, it growls, it whines. He has to walk him the long way around because it will not go down that path. Like, a dog must be able to sense it. So this apparition is there all the time, yeah, apparently. But it's like a really old, I suppose, sort of Guy Fawkes era that I can describe it as, really.
Yeah.
That's quite odd.
That is scary, but... good scary. It's like
it's good scary,
yeah, like what they call a unintelligent haunting, because it's kind of looping, as you said, you know,
yeah,
doing the same things over and over again. But yeah, animals are so sensitive. They've never been told, have they, there's no such things as ghosts? So
the animals are very tuned into stuff like that, you know. Animals, they can sense stuff. I think because they go by instinct more than we. I think when we were kids and babies, probably we allow instincts to take over. And then we go to school and we're told that it's all nonsense and you've got to be logical about stuff, analyse it all. Whereas animals, they go purely by instinct alone. So that if they see something or feel it, they just go by what their instinct is telling them rather than judging it. So I think they're more tuned in because of that. It's like when they had that tsunami, all the birds flew away before it happened. Like, they knew it's going to happen. You know, the animals are very tuned in with stuff like recording, like a projection. You know, it's almost like a loop. But it's like a memory of the land or a memory being replayed, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. In one of the houses I used to live in about 6 or 7 years ago, it was a very, very old property. And it used to be part of a pub, but it was kind of converted into two houses. And we were in the smaller of the two properties. And in the kitchen area, I'm assuming this was like a very kind of busy, you know, thoroughfare area for the pub, because every now and again when I was washing up, I would feel, you know, like when a gentleman goes past a lady in the pub, they put their hand in the small of their back.
Is it? Sure, yeah.
And it would feel like that, and there's nobody there. I'm sort of looking around going, what's all this about, you know? But it would happen quite regularly, not menacing at all, never had anything sort of like really horrible vibes. It was just, you know, a regular that used to visit the pub coming in and making his way through the crowd. So, yeah. It does happen quite a lot. I've seen, you know, lots of different things in that respect. But yeah, when you have a spirit that comes through, that does talk to you and kind of gives you this information, a bit of a guide, if you like, on that respect.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's amazing what kind of things come through then.
Exactly. You get all sorts of information as well. I mean, like I say, one thing I do with the Ouija board is, like, I've got this special designed Ouija board where it's got pictures on it as well. So, like, if you get, we've had spirits before come through that didn't speak English very well. We had one came through at one seance, and there's also, and it's they're on the, because I let the people that are coming to the event do the Ouija board, and I sort of oversee it. But it was like spelling out gibberish. Well, it looked like gibberish. I said, that's just talking nonsense. I can't understand this. And this woman put her hand up. She goes, actually, that's German. I speak German. They're speaking fluent German.
Wow.
So she went over and spoke to it. None of us understood it, but she was speaking in German to spirit, and it's answering fully. And the planchet was moving much quicker once she got up there. So we had that happen before. And also, we've had people that we do historical seances where we contact the people that lived and worked in the area that we're visiting. So it's an old building. Sometimes people can come through from like 200 years ago, but they may have been like farmers, or I suppose they called them peasants at the time. Mm-hmm. And in those days, only the rich people read, or could read and write. So their spelling is atrocious, and some of it, the spelling is in Old English.
Oh.
Do you know what I mean? So it comes through, they speak differently to us. The spelling is not going to be the same as how we would spell things. And some of them are very literate. We had children come through, and of course, their spelling is not great. If it's like a three-year-old child. So what we do, because we've got pictures on there, we can just say, are you happy or sad? And it points to a happy face, and how did you pass over? And there's pictures there, like, it's a fire. Oh, did you die in a fire? Yes, you know. So it cuts out all the spelling of it for a start. And also it makes it easier. It's easier for somebody to point at a picture if they don't really understand fully than to spell it out.
Yeah.
So they might understand that question. You know, if I submit someone who's German, I might say, you know, what did you do as a job? He might be able to say, you know, I was an author or whatever, but can't spell the word, but I might spell it in German. But if you can point at a picture of a book, you can say, there, did you write? Yes. You know, and then that's how we do it, you know. And the sessions can get a lot more out of them that way and a lot quicker.
Yeah.
Because we're using images as well as numbers. So if someone speaks another language or they're not that literate, they can still communicate very strongly with us because we've allowed for that.
That is really it's a very simple way of doing it, and yeah, it kind of transcends the language barrier. So yeah, that's brilliant.
It's because I had experiences where I did have people come through who didn't speak English, or people that weren't very literate, and I thought, how do I get around this, you know? So that's what we do here. But it's a very interesting thing to come through on a Ouija board before. We once had a guy came through, and he said that he was Jewish, and he was very upset because he was buried, and they read out again a Christian funeral, he's not a Christian.
Sure.
You know, so we had to Google the rites, the last rites for a Jewish funeral, and read it out to him. And after that, he said thank you and went. So it's kind of making his spirit rest. You know what I mean? So you get stuff like that come through. You know, you get, and a lot of the things that's really strange is we do the I do a lot of research. If we do historical sounds and somebody comes through, lived in the area, of course nowadays we can Google things and look them up. You know, I mean, you could do it before by going to the local records in the library or whatever, but it's easier now to do it at home. So if somebody comes through, ask them very specific questions about their name and where they lived. And we had one seance we were doing, we started on the Ouija board, and where this bloke came through, and he was a highwayman, and he worked in the area, because the area that we were doing it in, there was a lot of highwaymen around there at the time. And this guy was quite, I suppose you could say he was humorous or cheeky, you know, he's quite funny, I suppose you could say, or quite trying to wind us up a little bit. And during the seance, this highwayman came through, and this girl went into a trance and started speaking in this man's voice, and said she was this highwayman. But when we turn the lights on at the end of the seance, there's one girl who's sitting there. There was a feather in front of her that appeared during the seance, like a port, I suppose you could say, like a white feather. And she sort of said, "Oh well, you know, that must be my dad, because when I was young, he used to always pick up a white feather and give it to me if he was out on a walk." You know, so well, fair enough. The next day, we Googled this highwayman, and we found it. We had his name. We'd written it down. He did exist. He did operate in that area, and the funny thing was that his gang was nicknamed the White Feather Gang, because their calling card after they'd robbed someone was leaving a white feather.
Oh my gosh.
So we wouldn't have known that if we didn't have the power of technology mixed with, you know, what we were supposed to call Victorian methods of spirituality. Because obviously this goes back to Victorian times. The sort of seance we was doing is very Victorian, and the Ouija board and everything else. We managed to combine the two and get some research and get validation for what we found out. So That's the important thing, though, is getting that validation sometimes can make it even more interesting afterwards. Mm. Yeah, you get the event, and then it's finding out, then looking into it and finding out afterwards, well, actually, that is true, because we looked it up and backs up. And this is such an obscure highwayman that no one would have known that. I don't think anyone could have been pushing the board and spreading that out, because I don't think anybody there had a particular interest in history. And this is such an obscure person that there was only one or two references we could find to him anywhere. It wasn't like Dick Turpin or nothing. It was a very obscure person that no one really would have heard of. So I was quite pleased with that. That was a very lovely experience.
Yeah. What about saying, you know, incorporating technology? Do you use like EVP machines, getting the recordings of voices at all? Do you do that?
I do. I'll tell you what I do. I don't use the modern equipment as well. Again, I use something very old, because when I was a youngster, a long, long time ago, there was a magazine that came out called The Unexplained, one of these part work things, what I said about before. It was all about ghosts and everything, UFO, the lot, you know. And the first issue had a flexi disc. Remember them floppy records you could get with a magazine?
Oh, right, yeah.
He used to put it, it's like a floppy record. It used to be free of a magazine. You put it on a record player, put a 2p on there to keep it rigid. And what this record was, it was a Russian guy called Konstantin Raudovay. And I think it's in the 40s or 50s. He's the person that pioneered EVP. And what he did is he tuned a radio into a white noise frequency. And he asked his spirits questions. And these voices, they're quite distant voices, but you could hear them when it's recorded. I think if you Google Raudovay EVP on YouTube, it should come up, the actual original flexi disc on there. Actually, my recording project I do, we've released a song, which is an instrumental piece. We've got samples from that recorded on there. But what it is, I decided to try to tune into a white noise frequency to try and connect with spirit, you know. And what he was doing, he was asking them questions and then recording it and then playing it back. And the time that I did it, I remember the person from, do you remember that program Dad's Army?
Yes.
Do you remember Arthur Lowe, the main, you know, stupid Maury, one of the glasses here? Yeah. He just died at the time, you know, and I think it was in the early 80s or whatever, and I was doing this EVP, and I was trying to contact him, because he was on the news, and no one had known how he died at the time, because there was no internet, it's just that he'd passed away. And I was speaking, there was, like, voices coming through, we were very distant, it was like his voice, but then his heartbeat came through, and it kind of started getting faster and faster and faster and faster and faster, and stopped. And then later on the day, they revealed the news that he died of a heart attack. You know, so I was quite interested in using this method of EVP rather than the usual ones that people use now. So I've got a very old radio, and I've got a friend of mine to lock it into a white noise frequencies, so it doesn't tune into radio stations. So I can put it on scan, and what it does is it scan different white noise frequencies until it finds one with a sound on it or a voice coming through. So it won't have anything to do, you know, so you won't suddenly get Radio 1, you won't get Ed Sheeran ruining the atmosphere with his droning. So it cuts out all the music side of things and just picks up white noise frequencies. So I use that. And it's been very effective. We've had voices come through, we've had stuff happen there, and it's been very useful, you know. So, but I tend to favour the Victorian or the old style hands-on techniques. We use a lot of pendulums in the stuff we do. And a lot of Ouija boards and stuff. Because when I people come onto these events, I like people to be able to go and do it themselves.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a lot of people that come to the events I do are curiosity seekers or people that are interested, some of them, you know, have never experienced it before. So with a pendulum, you know, you could either make one yourself or buy one, obviously, but you could make one yourself. You could put a tie ring on a hair and do it so they can go home and do that. We do like a spirit contact thing with a wine glass, and you hold a pendulum in the wine glass and you ask the spirit to knock on the glass. And it taps, you know, and you can ask simple questions, any yes or no questions, like one tap for yes, two for no. But you can do that for wine glass. It's a nice little way to get the atmosphere going and get the initial contact with the spirits. And people can go away and do it themselves. So I think people do like to be able to think, well, yeah, you know, I had a good experience. Now I can do that myself, you know. So we sort of kind of guide people a little bit. It's almost like a training session as well as an event, so people can learn how to do things.
Yeah, good little workshop. That is very interesting. Yeah, I want to go now.
yeah, we do a lot of these sort of things. I mean, I've been quite ambitious before. I've tried to get really. There's some seances I want to do, but it's getting the permission to go to certain buildings sometimes. I mean, a lot of these where I live in Berkshire, there's a lot of very old churches, but they were attached to Victorian workhouses. So the Victorian, you know, there's an old hospital. It's a hospital now, but it used to be a Victorian workhouse. And they've got this beautiful Victorian church there. Everything in it is exactly the same as it was since 1835, I think, apart from the organ being replaced. But the thing is, because they're Christians, they don't really agree with me dabbling in the occult, as they say, and hiring it for the night to do an event there. But I'm sure it'd have a lot of presence there. But the one thing I wanted to do one at the Tower of London, you know, the princes in a tower, you know, Richard III and the princes, because they found skeletons there, didn't they, on the stairs of two children. They believe that the story is true, you know, the Shakespeare thing, but and about the princes in the tower. But the money they're charging for that, to hire that for the evening, is astronomical. I'd like to charge everybody about $2,000 to come to that. But the other one I really want to do is an elephant man seance, because the locations are still there, you know, around London. I mean, the building that he was exhibited in, the elephant man, in Victorian times, it used to be like a shop opposite the hospital, you know, the hospital where he stayed. Yeah. It's now still there. It's a sari shop, like Indian clothes.
Yeah.
And the storeroom at the back of the sari shop is where the elephant man was exhibited. So you pay at the front and you go around the back and you see the elephant man there and, you know, come out of this cage or whatever. And that actual room is still there, and it's opposite the hospital where he lived. So all the locations are around there, you know, to do with the elephant man. But it's very hard to try and get them to understand that I wanted to use their storeroom to contact the elephant man. You know what I mean? So that would have been a perfect location. I mean, the people at the hospital were very accommodating and friendly, because the bones of the elephant man are there and some of his personal effects. But the actual building, the part of the building that he lived in, was demolished in the Second World War. I think a bomb hit it, and that part of the building where he lived, the room he stayed in, is gone. But they've got a lot of his personal effects there. But that's one of my ambitions, just to do an elephant man sounds, because a lot of people do around these Jack the Ripper sounds, don't they, around London and stuff like that. But I think that's been done to death, so I'd like to try to do an elephant man one if I can.
Yeah, bring something different in.
Yeah, or Craterin's one at the Brian Beggar pub or something, you know.
Yes,
Ranch Road, Ronnie and Reggie in the spirit world.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be quite good.
It would be, yeah. Have you had any kind of like quite disturbing experiences when you've been, you know, doing workshops or out giving seances? Has anything kind of like really been shocking in amongst the seance, you know, energy there?
We have before, yeah. When I tend to be quite do a lot of protection before I start them anyway, because my background is I was in a coven for a while, and I studied magic, witchcraft, you know, black and white magic, that kind of stuff. You know, I'm very into all that kind of thing. So I tend to, before I do an event, I tend to purify the room, you know, or put salt in each corner and do some chants before I start. So I do every element I can to protect it. But I have had experiences, more the ones that I've gone out on my own with friends to do things in the urban exploration, rather than the ones we had the public in. But we have had some strange things happen. Once there was a bookshelf in one of the rooms. It was an old library we were doing it at, and this book literally flew across the room and hovered in the air. And that was quite strange. And one was like an abandoned, it's in the middle of nowhere, like an abandoned pub. And this pub used to be a courtroom years ago. And the bit that's the kitchen used to be the cells where they keep people that are going to be hung, you know. And there used to be a gibbet there, I think, as well. They used to sort of display the bodies, you know, of people who have been executed. But this pub was quite an eerie feeling. You know, there's like people touching your shoulder, and it was a horrible feeling. But we had the door open at one point. It's like a big wooden, it's a huge oak door. The wind could not blow this door. It's so heavy. You have to really push it hard. And when the door was open, as we were sitting there, suddenly this door slammed, bang, like that, slammed. And there was no one there. And that was quite, I think because it was so loud, it was startling. And it would have taken someone to move that sort of force. It would have taken probably two people to push it. Mm. It's a big, thick door, you know. So I've had some things like that before. And I've had some people that have been freaked. I mean, the sounds is, you have to bear in mind that some people haven't been to these before. I've had people sort of fainting or freaking out. And being overwhelmed by it, you know. So we just have to deal with those kind of situations, calm them down, you know. There's one girl who came to one of the seances once, and she came along. It's a Halloween. We did one at the Halloween time. And when she turned up, we usually build it up before we get to the more, you know, the deeper stuff. So it's sort of like we give a little talk, we demonstrate pendulums, we do different things here, you know, a bit of trance with people. And then we sort of go onto the Ouija board, and then at the end we have a dark seance, you know. So it gets more involved as it goes along, you know. But the early part, we always did the pendulum. Once the pendulum started moving, tapping on the glass, this girl just freaked out. She sort of started screaming and that. And she sort of passed out. I said, "What's that?" She goes, "Well, I thought this was a Halloween party. I didn't think it's going to be real." Actually, I thought it was people dressed up, you know, and there's vampires and Frankenstein and that. I said, no, it's quite clearly said in the advertising that this is a paranormal event. And you know, we put warnings saying that people with a nervous disposition shouldn't come, or you come at your own risk and that, because it can be freak people out. But she was all right. She went in the bar, got drunk, met some bloke, and went off home with him. So she had a good. There's different kind of spirits that she experienced that night, anyway. But you know, you do get things like that. But yeah, you know, the weirdest experience I think I've had. Well, the weirdest experience, the most scary experience I've had.
Yeah.
Was one where there was an area. It's like a woodland and like a forest area. And there was a pub there, and we were drinking in there, me and my friend. And this chap said, "Oh, there's a vampire there. It's like a vampire in the woods there." And we thought he's just talking rubbish, you know. It's like a being with like a person, but it's got glowing red eyes, you know. And we thought, and it says known there. They reckon there was like a bridge. There, like a small bridge, you walk on a path, a small bridge. Underneath this bridge, there was like mud there. And this vampire, apparently, years ago, it's urban myth, I suppose, attacked this girl, drained her body of blood, and left the body under this bridge. And even in the summertime, it was wet, damp under there, never dried where he left his body. So we just thought this guy was trying to scare us and wind us up, you know. Anyway, about a week later, this guy came in the pub, scared as anything, you know, and he was quite a big bloke, not the sort of bloke that gets scared easy. And he was shaking, his eyes wide, and he'd seen this vampire. And he jumped over like a sort of, you know, 12-foot fence to get away from it. So I said to my mate, "Do you want to go and have a look for this? You know what I mean? We'll go there one night." So we did the usual thing. It was a bit Hammer Horror. I said, "You know, we get some garlic with us and all this." Do you know what I mean? We'd obviously read too many Dracula comics in the 70s, so we had, you know, a wooden stake with us and everything else. We went down there, we were looking around all night, but then this thing come running at us. We couldn't really see what it was, but it did seem to have glowing red eyes. But it was moving. It's moving so fast. It wasn't like a human. You know, like something sped up, like in a film. You know, like that. What's that film, Predator?
Oh,
like
yeah.
That kind of thing. It's like blurry. You could just about see it, and it's like moving really fast. we just ran out of there. We thought, I can't be out there, because this is about 2 a.m. We just ran. You know. But there are reports of vampires. You know, there's a vampire in London at Highgate Cemetery. You know about the vampire in Highgate Cemetery?
Yeah, gosh.
Because I did a seminar last year, and like a paranormal seminar. I was comparing it. And we had David Farrant on there, who's one of the guys who was involved in that.
Oh, right.
You saw that. Yeah, and he's one. He got a lot of trouble. I think they sort of tried to do it for desecrating graves, because he was trying to get rid of this vampire at the time. But he got a lot of trouble with the police over it. But that was a big story in the 70s, the Highgate vampire. There's two people that had seen it, that were trying to get rid of it, and they were sort of battling. One was a priest called Sean Manchester, and Dave Farrant, who's the head of the London Occult Society. But he's a very interesting guy, you know, and it's a very interesting story, what you have to say about it. But that's still there. The entity vampire, whatever it is still there around the Highgate Cemetery.
Oh my goodness. Do you know, this is the really weird thing. My front door's just literally flown open.
There you go.
I've just been sat here, and I'm pretty sure I locked it after I took that parcel, and it's just flown open. Oh my God.
You never know.
I might have to go and shut that, but I might have to get some garlic out. Who knows?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, you've got to be careful.
Right. Definitely locked at this time. Definitely
excellent,
locked.
Yeah. Well, I always tell people are very scared by things like this because it's the unknown. But yeah. I always tell people that living people can harm you more than the dead.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, the spirits can scare you, but they can't do anything to you. You know, I've not ever seen anybody hurt as such by a spirit. I mean, I've had things push me against walls and stuff like that, but not cause me any damage as such. Maybe a bruise.
Mm.
When I went to that asylum, that one in Cane Hill, I was sort of thrown across the room. Yeah. By nothing, but it just I had a bit of a bad back next day, and that's it. But you know, a person could do much more damage than that. So I think people are more scared of the unknown, or scared of things they've not experienced before, rather than what they can do, rather than what it is. Yeah, if they see a ghost, the ghost's not doing anything or harming them, but they're scared because they've not seen it before. Whereas if you've seen them a lot, or you work in that field, you're no longer scared of it, because it's to you it's normal.
You
accept it, you know.
Yeah, and I think Hollywood and all their sensationalism with a lot of horror films, you know, you do see like these different exorcism type films. They can really kind of put fear into people. But yeah, all the haunting experiences I've had, yes, they've been a little bit like, ooh, that's weird. But nothing's ever, you know, tried to harm either of us. I mean, Alan's had experiences as well along the way, but it's more of about either they want to be known, they want to, you know, let you know that they're there, they're over watching over what you're doing in my place, so to speak.
So I think it's trying to communicate, really. It's just like talking. I mean, I say to people, when people go, like, the Ouija boards, I think it scares people the most, because they've seen those horror films, you know. And we had one bloke who came, he's a bloke, you know, quite a big bloke, and he'd never been to seance before, but and his mate had been loads of times, his mate's a regular, but he put on Facebook, you know, hey guys, I'm going to a seance tonight, what do you think, and all that. It's a bit for attention, you know what I mean? Of course, you've got a response from all these idiots that watched horror films. Oh, you're going to get possessed by the devil. Oh, your kids are going to get possessed. You're going to be in demon zone with you, and all that. Oh, you're going to take your soul and all that. So when he came there, he was scared shitless. Do you know what I mean? He's terrified when he arrived, you know what I mean? Because of all these films, you know. And people get so wound up by stuff, you know, because of they've seen all these horrible, silly things like paranormal activity and silly things like that, which is not really an accurate representation of what using a Ouija board is like, because people go there, they use it, and they think, actually, it's all right, you know. But I always say it's like a telephone, you know. I mean, when you've got your finger on a planchet, what is making the board work is your energy. You know, you're putting your finger on that planchet, and the energy of the people there is allowing the spirit to use your energy to make that planchet move. So if you want to finish a phone call, you hang up. If you want to stop a conversation with the Ouija board, take your finger off the planchet, and that's the equivalent of hanging up, you know. That's what I say to people.
Yeah.
You know, so it's calming people down. There's a lot of nonsense that people have in their head because of these films and stuff.
What's your opinion on things like, what's it called, Ghost Adventurers, which is the American version, or Most Haunted, as we've got over here? What's your take on that? Because some people don't like it. I mean, I don't mind watching it, but I think a lot of it is over sensationalized on there as well. A lot of it's debunked. But it is interesting. But what's your take on that?
Well, I'll take it a pinch of salt, because at the end of the day, it's on television, so therefore it's entertainment, you know. When I do seances, you know, we can have activity. We could go there and have a great night and activity, or we could go there and nothing could happen.
Yeah.
We will say to people before the seance, look, you know, nothing might happen tonight, you know, or something great might happen, you know.
Yeah.
The chances of something happening, you know, we can't control that. So So they know what they're themselves in for. But on TV, if nothing happens, that's not really the program to broadcast. So let's make it happen. Let's exaggerate. Let's act. Let's over dramatise it. And I think there's an element of that to it. You know, but having said that, I suppose the good side of these things, it does open people's minds up a little bit to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And spirit can be just so fickle. One day they'll go, yeah, we're going to put on a display and we're going to do all this stuff and move things. Another time, nope.
Yeah, it does. Sometimes nothing happens. You know, different things happen. You know what I mean? It's not like a show where they're, you know, it's you're investigating something. I mean, when anyone goes to a paranormal investigation, what it is, it's a paranormal investigation. You could have an EVP on the device all night and it doesn't make a sound and nothing comes through it. It doesn't beep or nothing. You know, you could get silence. You know, you could, yeah, I mean, Ouija board, I've never had that not be active. But sometimes you get them slow or not communicating very strongly, or you get some that are very fluid and they move the planchet about really good, you know. So it depends, you know. I don't feel that. I think the TV things, it alerts, it makes people more interested in it. So someone might watch the TV, even if it's exaggerated, someone might watch that and think, my mind's open to paranormal. I might go on a ghost hunt now and see what it's really like. And then they see what it's like for themselves and properly get into it. So it could be handy in introducing people that maybe haven't thought about it to things like that.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing, really, is it, you know?
That's very true. Now, in the grand scheme of things, it does kind of put people in touch with stuff that they have that interest in. And, like, you know, looking at the PG tips cards, that's what opened it all up for me. And then you had like the Arthur C. Clarke programs as well. I loved all of that sort of thing as a kid.
Yeah, they were great, those programs, yeah.
And you just don't get stuff like that now, do you? It's YouTube, and you get on YouTube is mostly people sort of telling ghost stories and again, over-sensationalising it and making it very dramatic because they want views, you know?
Yeah, and usually they're American and they're very in your face. And it's like, you tell us, we're going to investigate ghosts tonight. We're going to go here, man. It's like, oh my God, awesome. And you think, that's put me off it straight away. Whereas when you watch Arthur C. Clarke, they've got some bumpkins in Somerset. Well, it's Cyrus figure come through the sky. And for some reason, I believe them more. I don't know why. But if you watch some of those Arthur C. Clarke now, it's really dated, but they're real sort of, you know, really country bumpkins on there.
Yeah.
And they're people that don't seem to be looking for attention. I mean, there's one episode of Arthur C. Clarke was about, you know, like when it rains and fish come out of the sky and stuff like that. And there's a couple of interviews, this really old couple, you know, and they're so normal that they wouldn't make something like that up.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And they're not on television, and they seem almost embarrassed talking about it. So you think, well you know, they seem more feasible because they're not loud in your face. They don't want to be on telly. They don't want to be famous. You know, they just been, someone's tracked them down and interviewed them about it.
Yeah.
And basically, these people on these American things, they're like, look at this, man. It's like, oh, look at me. And you think, well, you're doing it for publicity. You want to be famous on YouTube. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what kind of detracts from the believability sometimes for me.
Yeah.
The presentation and the people they interview sometimes, you know.
Absolutely, yeah, I do agree with that. But you know, looking at it on a more deeper level, you can expect things not to be so harsh as people put it across, and I think, you know, when somebody does that, it can go one way or the other. It can open up a curiosity. Okay, so we had like a couple of years ago, I don't know if you remember, there was a big kind of viral challenge going on, as these things do, and it was that Charlie challenge where they balanced two pencils.
Yeah.
And that kind of, a lot of people got really worried about it. But I feel, you know, when stuff goes into the news, a lot of news is fake anyway. But now we've got this buzz phrase, fake news, haven't we, which can be applied to pretty much anything. But it's funny you should say about the fish coming from the sky, because I always make jokes, as I live, you know, literally about 10 minutes walk from Dartmoor, and we have like so many seasons in one day here, you know, the weather's always changing, and I always say like five seasons in one day, frogs coming out of the sky. But yeah, I quite believe it would be fish. Yeah, that'll be the next one.
Definitely. That's the thing, is those sort of things that obviously quite covered a lot of ground, you know. And I think these days, when you get a like a paranormal program on TV, they don't leave it open as such. They have to have a skeptic on there. And I think, is it a law they have to do that? Have some bloke in there debunking it? Like on that most haunted, there's a bloke there, oh no, there's a load of nonsense. And whereas Arthur Clarke sort of said, this is what it's about, make your own mind up. You know, that's what it was about, really.
I think
they allowed you to think
for
yourself a bit more in those days.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you for certain if it is a law, because, you know, we both know, working through, you know, psychic today, that certain things we can say one month can change the next month, you know, and the regulations are always like shifting. So it probably is something to do with the regulation, but I wouldn't be able to tell you that.
Yeah, I think it is. I say, when I watched these programs in the 70s, they used to have programs about ghosts and vampires and exorcisms and that, and they didn't really debunk it as such. They kind of presented the story from the people involved or whatever, and then at the end they sort of say, well, that's what happened, do you think it's real or not, make your own mind up. Then have some sort of smug bloke say, oh no, it left you to think for yourself. So you'd watch it and you think, and some of the stuff I'd watch and I think, I don't quite believe that, and other stuff I'd watch and I think, oh, there's something in that, you know. And it's good to be able to make your own mind up. I think in this day and age, I think that people think less for themselves, although we've got more access to information. I think people's opinions are more formulated.
Yeah.
You know, I think people are put more pushed to follow what they want or they're told to believe in. I think it's very corporate, and things that people are very controlled by what the media want them to think, more so than it was in the 70s and 80s is what I feel.
Yeah, very much so.
Do you know what I mean? So if someone wants you to believe something, they'll say, with this fake news, like the media, they tend to focus on certain stories. And I think it's more like that now than it was then. Even though you've got more information, you can look things up. I feel that it's still, particularly with things like Facebook and stuff like that, I've seen on there how people do follow a general opinion rather than think for themselves, which does alarm me. You know, people tend to sort of agree with, I suppose it's like a standard opinion, and they all agree with that rather than think for themselves. There are still some free thinkers, but not as many, I don't feel. I think in the 70s, you had that, the aftermath of the 60s thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's all the hippies, and it's all the hippies are into very much into the paranormal and Eastern mythology. Do you know what I mean? A lot of the hippies' songs were all about that, weren't it? And Hare Krishna and finding yourself and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I feel when I grew up, that sort of thing was still quite big, and people were more into exploring stuff, you know, and opening doorways and making your own mind up. Whereas nowadays, I think it's very much you're told what to think, and that's it. That hippie era was quite. There was a lot of progression there, you know. I think with that kind of area of things. I remember a lot of the books that were big around the 60s was that T. Lobsang Rampa. Do you remember his book?
No, I've not. I'll have to look that one up.
It's quite interesting. It's quite interesting because what it was, he'd written this book called The Third Eye. And it's quite an amazing book. It's about him having a journey. He's saying he was like a Tibetan monk, and he'd gone on this journey, and he'd opened up his third eye, and he'd met Jesus on this mountain and an alien. And it's really amazing stuff, you know. And it's all about, he's telling you the mysteries of the universe. And it's an interesting book. But then he found out that T. Lobsang Rampa was actually a plumber. From Bognor Regis, I think it was, called Cyril Hoskins.
Wow!
his real name was Cyril Hoskins. And when they found him out, they said to him, hang on a minute, the name's not T. Lobsang Rampa, but Cyril Hoskins. He turned and said, well, no, I'm actually a reincarnation of a Tibetan monk, and this is what I'm writing about. And, you know, he's channeling it through me. But he wrote a series of books. But they were very popular, those books, in the hippie era, in like the late 60s, all the hippies, you know. They're smoking their ganja and listening to the far out music and all that, and reading these books. And their minds are very open to that. But they've republished them. And I'm not sure you can get them on Amazon, but last time I saw them was in the mystery shop in Covent Garden. They had them in there, so they'd reprinted them, so they are available. But they are good books to read.
Yeah.
You know, they're fascinating, whether he's a plumber or not. They are good books to read.
Yeah.
T. Lobsang Rampa, that's his name.
I definitely have to have a nosy around, because we love our old bookstores. Alan's always having a delve into the bookstores, so I'll keep an
Excellent.
Eye out.
You'll enjoy them. Yeah, The Third Eye, he's written quite a few. The Third Eye was the first one, that's the one to read. You know, I think Alan would enjoy that. You know, you get hold of a copy of that. It's a good one.
Oh, fantastic. Right, well, it's been nearly an hour that we've been chatting, with a couple of interruptions, but not too many, thank goodness. Was there anything that you'd like to give the listeners, like a website that they can contact you through if they were interested in finding more out about, you know, the seances that you hold, etc.?
Yeah, on Facebook, I've got a group called the Occult Experience of Freddie Valentine. And if you join that group or request to join it, then you'll find out about all the events on there. They'll all be in that group. But I'm contactable on Facebook. So, and also, anyone who's interested in the podcast that we did, it's called The Mystic Menagerie. It covered all sorts of stuff. It covered dark, like films and music and all sorts of stuff as well. It's all to do with the paranormal and the darker side of things. I suppose it's a the dark side of the art world, really, and the paranormal. They're still on iTunes. So we stopped doing it now because the chap I did it with couldn't do it anymore. It's too much. There were 3-hour podcasts, so a lot of editing going on. Wow. I think he's got a lot on his hands. So we've done about 15 of them, I think, but they're all on there. We've got interviews with Right Said Fred, King Arthur Pendragon, you know, the druid, he's on there, yeah. Film directors and all sorts of stuff. So we've got quite a good guest on it. And we've got an actor from American Horror Story, Matt Fraser. So it's quite a lot of stuff like that. So you like alternative arts and the paranormal, it's all on there. And it's humorous as well. There's a lot of comedy in it as well. So that's all on iTunes if you want to hear it, Mystic Menagerie.
I will certainly check that out. It sounds right up my street. If I ever get time to sit and actually listen to stuff.
look for the episode with the story about Michael Jackson's ghost molesting a monkey. We covered that.
Oh my gosh.
Because there was a bloke in the newspaper. It was the Sport, the newspaper, but this bloke reckoned he had a pet monkey and Michael Jackson's ghost fiddled with it. So that we covered that story in depth and discussed was it true or not. So we covered all sorts of stories like that as well, unusual stuff that no one else would touch with a barge pole. The weirder the better.
Yeah,
but that's quite a funny episode. That's quite a good episode, that one.
Oh my gosh, yes, I will absolutely have to check that one out. Wow. Well, thank you so much for being my guest today, Freddie. It's been a real experience, very eye-opening, and I feel like, you know, a lot of the listeners out there will, you know, they'll realise that it's not all just us sitting around shuffling cards and fortune telling, so to speak.
Exactly. I dress in very 70s clothes, platform shoes, flared trousers. I consider myself to be like the glam rock paranormal investigator. So you don't have to be deadly pretentious about things. You can investigate things and enjoy it and do it with a different attitude. You know,
yeah.
You don't have to be one of these people that's. I'm not pretentious about things. I enjoy it and I know I'll make my own mind up. And I think it's for people, the message for people really is if you're interested in a paranormal, check it out for yourself, you know, and then make your own mind up. Don't be swayed by what people tell you. Go by what you feel and what you see and what you experience. Because everything in life's about experiencing things, you know, and if you experience something, and then to you it's real.
Yeah, absolutely.
It happened.
Fantastic. Oh, thank you so much for joining me, Freddie.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. You read my mind.
Is it? That's my job. That's what I do. It's been a lovely, lovely conversation with you, and it's lovely to be on your show.
Brilliant. Thank you for joining me. Okay, take care.
Have a nice day. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much, Freddie Valentine, there. Now, before we go to our next interview, which is with my very own husband, Alan Grace, I'm going to be playing a piece of music from a local band called Coney Island. So do check them out on Facebook and Twitter, and I'll put all of the links in the description for this band down below. So check them out. Here they are, Coney Island.
say something that I regret. I say something that you won't forget. Now that it's over, it didn't ever begin. Now that it's over, will we ever talk again? Now that it's over, it didn't ever begin. Now that it's over, will we ever talk again? I should have known it was just a kiss. I should have known it would end like this. I should have known we were almost done. I should have known we were having fun.
And welcome back to the Angela and Friends podcast. I'm here today with the wonderful Alan Grace.
Hello.
Hello, Alan. How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And tell our lovely listeners what it is that you do.
Right, the main thing that I do is writing. I write books, novels and short stories, and occasionally poetry.
Fantastic. And what are you working on at the moment, Alan?
The main thing I'm working on at the moment is editing a short story, which is science fiction.
Fantastic. Have we got any working titles with that, or is this going to be very much kept under wraps at the moment?
At the moment, it's got a working title.
Okay, fantastic. Fabulous. And with your work, you know, you say you do a lot of poetry. Is there anything that our listeners would be able to perhaps look at out there on the interwebs, or anything that you've had published at the moment?
Not at the moment, no. I do have a blog, but it does need updating. It's been neglected for a while.
Okay. Well, we can always link the blog here and have your interview put on it, because you're looking to expand. So there you go. And if any of our listeners are interested in the work that you're doing, then I'm sure that they can get in touch with you through that medium. Okay, Fantastic. And also you do a little bit of artwork as well. You're very much into the pyrography side of life as well. Yeah.
Pyrography, which is drawing with fire, similar to a soldering iron, burning pictures onto wood. I do engraving onto glass, which is drawing pictures onto glass. And I make candles.
Fantastic. Yeah, we've been working on the candles together because if you haven't already guessed, ladies and gentlemen, this is my husband. Yes, we have a lot of fun doing the candles together, so that's always nice. So as we are on Psychic Choice Radio, I wanted to kind of talk to you a little about your spiritual experiences, not just the paranormal stuff, but you know, spiritually as a whole as well. But do tell the listeners, because you've had many different occasions where you've come into contact with spirits over the years. So could you share some of your stories with our listeners?
Yes, growing up, the home I grew up in, I'm pretty convinced that it has some strange spirits in there. I've seen the loft hatch suddenly open. It's been shut. It's never come open for years and years. All of a sudden it comes open. Music playing in the loft, which was heard by myself and somebody else.
Me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hand coming around the door. The black cat, which has been seen by many, many people, including my dad, who's a non-believer. My gran, who'd never been told about it. She nearly tripped over it, in fact. Glowing orbs of light floating around the house. Quite a few strange things happening in the house.
Yeah. So definitely proof that there is more to life than our mere existence here at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you feel like any of the spiritual experiences or paranormal experiences have influenced your writing at all?
It's influenced me to write stories. I am quite a spiritual person. I'm quite religious as well, so that does help.
Okay, and tell our listeners about your journey to becoming, you know, more spiritually religious.
Yeah, I wasn't particularly spiritual. I suppose I might have been agnostic. Then I had a bit of a bad experience in life. I was walking past the church and I felt I should go into it, and that was when I had the conversion on the road to Damascus, as they say. Since then I've explored further my religion. Got confirmed into the Catholic Church only the other day.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, fantastic. Right, and on your spiritual path, as you've had that epiphany, you know, to become more religious in your life, one of the kind of challenges that you faced, and obviously I know this because I'm married to you, was the fact that many years ago, back in 2005, myself, I was offered an opportunity to read the tarot professionally, but at the time, you were very much against it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But as the years have worn on, you know, how have you seen the tarot and oracle cards from your point of view? You know, how do you feel that it's kind of grown with you?
Okay, I mean, first of all, I didn't believe it, because how could 72 cards?
78.
78 cards. How could they tell the future? And then I got convinced through various readings and hearing other people's readings that, you know, there is something in it. From a spiritual side, at first, I was of the view that it's dabbling in stuff that shouldn't be dabbled in. Research various different sites, a lot of religious sites, obviously a lot of Christian sites. The Christian community is very divided on it, but my view comes down on that it's okay. Obviously it's forbidden to foretell the future and have that power yourself, but if you draw the power through you. If you're the vessel and the power comes from God, the angels, Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it, then that's different.
Yeah,
that's how I view it. It says in the Bible that the prophets are okay. Most famous prophet, of course, being Jesus, who was a prophet. And I believe all the Abrahamic religions say that. Well, definitely Islam and Christianity say that he's a prophet. Christianity obviously puts him slightly higher. But there are other prophets as well in the Old Testament. There is one part, I can't remember which part, that says that if you have these abilities to use them. And my Catholic priest has said that. So yeah, I am comfortable that it is compatible with my own beliefs. I can't tell. I can't use the cards myself. It's not something that I have a skill with.
But you are very intuitive in yourself, because you have picked up on many different things on different occasions. And I've kind of gone down that road of angel numbers, and you've started to notice that a lot more happening with you and your ones 444, isn't it? Which is a very highly spiritual angel number. It's to do very much with the archangels and intuition. Yeah, cool. That's okay. We can edit this. Or not. We'll just leave it. Just cut, having a chat. delete. Okay. When it comes to, you know, your creative side, though, do you feel like you kind of draw your inspiration or get channeled by anybody? Who do you look up to? Who would be your person to go to in terms of inspiration?
Well, not spiritual, but I admire the people like Bernard Cornwell. I'd love to be at his level. Maybe one day. He is the ultimate that I want to get to. Wilbur Smith is another one. Arthur Conan Doyle, although it's not really my style, but fantastic writing. Tolkien, of course, being a fantasy writer. Tolkien is the master of fantasy. So I'd love to be able to get to that level.
Okay, fantastic. That's awesome. Yeah. Okay. What would be the piece of work that to date you are most proud of that you've done so far?
That's quite a difficult one. I mean, I've written 3 novels. Probably the one I'm most proud of is my science fiction one. Set in the present day with science fiction technology, sort of cyberware sort of stuff, or biomechatronics, to use the correct terminology. That's probably one I'm most proud of. I'm presently redrafting that, making big changes before I send it off again. Short stories, probably a Zulu romance, because it's different. It took a lot of research to do that, and it's quite sweet as well. Enemies drawn together in the middle of a war, and totally different culture, totally different ways of looking at the world.
Yeah, you're very interested in like the Zulu history as well, aren't you? Yeah. So there's a lot of research that's gone into that, and it's not something that anybody could just kind of like go to the keyboard and start writing about, because you've had a lot of passion around, you know, the Zulu era from quite a young age, I believe.
Yes, like a lot of people, I saw the Zulu film, thought it was fantastic, and it triggered off my passion, and I've been researching it ever since and writing stories around it. I've got 2 or 3 written around Zulu time.
And you're able to kind of recall some of the names of like the leaders and what have you as well, which, I find that very impressive that, you know, you take such an avid interest in history. It is your thing, as you say, very much linking back into, you know, like Bernard Cornwell kind of novels with The Last Kingdom, etc., etc. Yeah, which is a not plugging the series, but it is quite a good one.
Yes.
We can draw a lot of inspiration from that.
I think I was born about 150 years too late. I'm a Victorian trapped in a modern body.
Which leads us nicely into a little bit of like family research that you were doing. And this one particular, was it a cricketer, came up as well?
I haven't confirmed it, but I haven't confirmed it. W.C. Grace, that was it. Chap with a big bushy beard like myself. Fantastic cricketer. I'm curious to find out whether I am actually related to him. I think that I even look like him in some photographs, especially now my beard is catching up with his. I do have beard envy with him as well.
Beard envy.
Although I know nothing about cricket.
It's just not cricket, my dear.
No.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, let's bring it up to like present day, where we are at the moment. As you know, living in this house, for our listeners, we've only been in this property for about just over 12 months now. And there's been some activity around this property. Now, I've talked about this on a few shows, but from your perspective, what have your experiences been?
I've definitely smelled a smell of tobacco, and none of us three that live here smoke. We don't have many visitors who smoke, so they haven't left the scent behind. But I have smelled that as well. Definitely when I was on my own, strange noises coming from upstairs when I've been downstairs and there's no one there. I've checked out on several occasions.
When I was away last year as well.
Yes. Checked out with a big axe, just in case.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. If it is spirit, they very, very rarely, you know, harm us. In fact, there's not a lot that they can do in that respect to harm us. But, precaution is always a good thing. Prevention is better than cure. But, yes, there's definitely activity in this house, and it was confirmed by our neighbour. That this was, you know, validated, so to speak, with the previous occupant, well, not previous occupant, previous owner of this house, who also was very spiritual, and, you know, his wife was all about the crystals, and, yeah, they were a lovely spiritual couple. So I feel like there was a reason we were drawn to this particular property.
But, yeah, we had the choice of two. Pretty much identical. There's slight differences, but not that much. But we chose this one, which ended up, as we found out afterwards, is a very spiritual place.
Yeah, they had garden landscaped with crystals and statues, you know, spiritual statues in place there as well. So that was really lovely to find that out and have it confirmed. But the tobacco smell, I don't know if you've noticed this, Alan, it's not like your usual tobacco. It's more of a sweeter smelling to it. Yeah, the sweet woodbine, as they would say. And that was confirmed again by my neighbour next door. Also as well, the door here, which happened in the last podcast, you know, if you listen back to that at the beginning of the show with Freddie Valentine, the door just suddenly swings open every now and again, doesn't it? So I think Chris likes to keep the door wide open for many reasons. There's a lot of symbolism in that. Okay. Was there anything that you would like to, you know, give to the readers, look at me, to the listeners today? Okay. Oh, hang on a sec. We get a lot of people coming in on the show asking in readings, because they're on a very creative path, and they've, you know, had a few disappointments along the way. What would your advice be to somebody who is kind of just starting out or wanting to make a name for themselves?
Probably the same advice that I received a long time ago from Terry Pratchett, which is you write. If you don't write, then you're not going to achieve anything. If you write, then you're going to get something done. Even if you write and then chuck most of it away, you've written something. You're flexing that writing muscle. And sometimes, some good comes out of it. something fantastic will be there. So writing a book, one thing that it is difficult to do, because I keep going back and editing, but I shouldn't do that. Get all the words down. You can edit later. So just go for it. Try not to worry about research, historical accuracy. Did they have toothbrushes in the 1800s or whatever? Worry about that later. You can go and change it. You can have, brushes teeth later, or not brushes teeth, whatever they did in those days. Just get it all written. Get the basic bare bones written. You can't have a person unless you've got the bones there to hold them up. So get there, write it, done. Then go and edit. And editing is boring. But it's got to be done.
Yeah, that is the one thing a lot of creative people do, you know, not enjoy so much the editing side of things. So did you have something to add?
And turn off Facebook.
Yeah.
Facebook is a terrible distraction, and I'm not alone. I know lots of people on Facebook that say that it's a distraction. Other writers that are writing on Facebook saying what Facebook distraction is, what distraction Facebook is.
Do you find that the writing groups that you're in on social media are helpful as well?
Yes, because I realise writing is very solitary. A lot of arty things, you can do it with other people. Yeah, acting, you have to do it with other people. Writing, you can't. Yeah. You're on your own. In fact, you want to be in this little bubble while you're writing, trying to avoid any outside contact. But it's very, very lonely. So if you realise other people have exactly the same problems as you, fantastic.
Yeah, that's good to have the support for each other. Obviously, I'm not in a writing group myself, but it is something that you have done in the past in person as well. You were in a creative writing circle back in college.
Yes, that was a brilliant group. I'm in contact with a couple of them still, even after all these years. Most of them have dropped out of writing, sadly, but I haven't yet grown up, so...
I think that's wonderful that you really are, you know, tenaciously driving forwards towards that goal, you know, and you have had rejection letters along the way, yet you still are going forward and you do change how you write.
Yeah.
You take on board the constructive criticism, which I think is something we can all learn from. Me included. But yes, I feel that's really inspirational that you are keeping on, you know, moving forwards with that. And hopefully, you know, somebody will listen to this and okay, you know, maybe want to take that a little step further for you, which would be lovely. But
I'm working on 3 different novels at once. High science fiction, my normal science fiction, and a fantasy. The fantasy one has got a massive world behind it because I've been working on all the background over the years, constantly adding, you know, new races, history, cultures, adding all to it constantly.
That must be amazing to be inside your brain sometimes. It must be like
scary too.
Skyrim versus I don't know.
Warhammer. And, you know,
yeah.
Tolkien, influenced by so many different things. Real life influences, real history. You know, all the fantasies that I've picked up over the years influencing it. Getting my own ideas. Mythology.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of Warhammer, we're not going to go too heavily on that one because there is an opinion that we will not share on air on that, ladies and gentlemen. However, linking in slightly with this, you used to play Advanced Hero Quest back in the day. We still have it. And you draw a lot of inspiration from those characters as well. I remember you telling me about this. You know, you would have certain stories that you'd set up around them.
Yes, Advanced Hero Quest and also Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. The roleplay systems are brilliant because you make a character who then goes and does stuff. And sometimes those characters are so influential, you convert it to be your own story. You know, you take it out of the world that somebody else has created, stick it in your own world. So yeah, I mean, I have had a few characters born that way.
Would you say with... this is kind of leading into you know, how we have Skyrim and what have you these days. Would you say there was more creativity and more room for, you know, imagination with such systems as Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, Shadowrun, that kind of thing, than there are with the current, you know, video games that are available?
Yes. The old roleplay systems, the pen and paper ones, six-sided dice, 10-sided dice, 100-sided dice, depends which system you play. There were no limits. As long as the games master allowed it, you could do it. You're not confined by the rules that the computer game has written. I know with Skyrim in particular, you have all the expansions that people add on to it, which allows you to do extra bits, but you're still confined by what they do. In Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, Skyrim, whatever, Shadowrun, if your character wants to suddenly fly, as long as you can justify it, you can do it.
Yeah.
I've had people fighting in cities that are actually monsters. I've had people with guns when they shouldn't have guns. I've had magical bows that does this, that and the other. Absolutely crazy ideas, some of them, but some of them are fantastic, really imaginative. It'd be good if people went back to that.
Yeah.
I mean, people do have a lot of background to their characters in Skyrim and those sort of games, but you're still confined to what is written in to the computer program.
Yeah, you are bound by a lot of restrictions.
Yeah.
But we've had, because I think people kind of have this preconceived idea that people that play, well, we've never really done Dungeons and Dragons together, but it's that would be the kind of nearest thing that many people would liken it to.
Yeah.
That you're kind of all really weird and you kind of lock yourselves away in a room and it's a bunch of guys, usually. However, I have played Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and Shadowrun myself, so it's not just, you know, gender specific, but that they kind of think it's a little bit strange, and some people kind of think it's a little bit occult as well, you know. I'm using the word occult as in it being viewed from the bad point of view rather than it being viewed from the hidden knowledge point
of
view.
There was a group of people, I think in the 80s, that tried to get Dungeons and Dragons banned for being occult. But I don't see why. It's not. Yes, you have demons in it and nasty creatures, but so do lots of things. And as long as you're able to realise it's fiction compared to reality, then that's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings me to something that I feel like I've maybe mentioned to many of my callers as well, that people do have problems, and I feel like it's becoming more of an increasing, you know, common problem, that people cannot differentiate between fantasy and reality. Because we see, like, we don't watch soap operas per se, but a lot of people kind of try to draw parallels with those things, don't they? And it's actually not real life. So when you're bringing in fantasy and you are, you know, living through your worlds, it's escapism for you, isn't it? Very much so. What's your views on that?
I have seen it where some people say that the fantasy genre is against beliefs, religions, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you've got to remember that some of the most influential people were devout Christians. Tolkien,
yeah,
you know, the granddad of modern fantasy was Christian. C.S. Lewis was a Christian as well, so they had no issues with it.
Yeah, and they can very much differentiate between what is real and what is, you know, completely made up or drawn in a little doodle that becomes a character. I feel like a lot of people do struggle with that these days, you know, which is a shame, because you kind of blocking yourself, aren't you, creatively?
But if it's wrong to pretend to be an orc, it's wrong to pretend to be a barmaid in EastEnders, you know, so therefore you might as well get rid of all the actors.
Yes.
And stuff like that.
Just to reiterate, ladies and gentlemen, when we talk about going back to the subject of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, Dungeons & Dragons, Shadowrun, etc. And the like, we're not the kind of LARPers, we're not live action role playing. No. This is very much done table based with pen and, well, paper and dice, isn't it, really? But you can have that element of acting brought in.
Yes, I mean, but even LARPing, if you want to do that, if you want to, if you're at a weekend you want to pretend to be an orc or an elf, that's fine. But most normal people know that once they take their chain mail off, that's it, they're back to being Fred the sausage packer or whatever his job is. I mean that in a factory way, not in a rude way.
Okay. That's for another show. Oh, fantastic. You go to
www. But, I mean, anything that's fictional, people take it too far. They think it's real. It can be dangerous. You know, you get these people that go shooting up schools or whatever because in their mind they think that whatever they've seen on TV is real, and so they go crazy. Where do you stop? Some people don't like games where you shoot people up, you know, Call of Duties, things like that, and yet millions and millions and millions of people play it, no problems.
Yeah. It's such a fine line, isn't it, you know, between the two. And for some people, it is kind of overseeing that. But I think if you can, you know, let your mind be creative, it's a healthy thing to have, very healthy thing to have. Okay, fantastic. Right, was there anything else that you would like to add to this podcast at all, Alan?
Well, if there's any publishers out there.
Why not? Plug away, plug away.
So, high fantasy, high science fiction, action in present-day Iraq is another novel, another fantasy, another science fiction. What else have I done? Horror, I'm working on. There's an idea for horror as well, which I'm working on, set in the countryside. Another horror, actually, which is slightly different, which involves lots of undead. Set in Devon, if I didn't mention that bit. I've got lots of ideas for novels, too many novels to write and not enough time to write them.
Your brain must be crushed full of ideas.
Yes, I have all these voices in my head.
Sounds very familiar.
And when I try and plan my novels, my characters tell me to go a different way. I wrote a story recently, had it all planned out all perfectly, and then the characters told me to go this way, and the entire genre changed because of what the characters did.
Yeah, I think that's good that you can, you know, very much grow to like your characters, and they feel to be like real people. And I feel like, you know, it's difficult sometimes when you have to kill a character off, for example.
That yeah, if I, like, them too much, they don't get killed off in the end. Something else happens to them.
A twist of fate.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, cool. Awesome. Right, trying to think now, what other okay, we'll stop for a second. Right, let's go back to when you were a child, and you used to keep a diary. But you used to, you know, draw a lot of inspiration from things around you, life events, etc, etc. And would that be something that you would, you know, recommend to children out there to still do today?
Yeah, I mean, it's good to write a diary and go back years later and realise what a pillock you were. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah.
If you're a writer, it's definitely a place to draw inspiration from. And sometimes it's good to reminisce. You know, you go back, you read it, and you think, oh, yeah, I remember that now. I remember going out to see Auntie Jenny in the Fleet and Firkin pub in the New Forest, wherever it was. So it's like a written photo album. Obviously, it depends on who the audience is as to what you write in it. So don't write that you fancy so-and-so at school if your brother's going to find it. I know that through experience.
Ooh.
Ooh, yes. Good old brothers. I just love them.
Well, I wouldn't know. I don't have any experience on that front, thankfully.
I think I've still got mine somewhere hidden deep away in a cupboard.
Most likely. That's another thing as well, being that you're a creative mind, you very rarely let go of stuff.
Actually, while I'm on that, Advice to any writer. You asked for advice earlier. Back it up.
Yes.
The amount of times my computer has died on me, which is one reason I'm rewriting my science fiction story, is because I've sent it to a publisher, well, an agent, who said, make these changes. So I had to make the changes, and the computer died. And I lost it all.
Mm.
Ouch.
Yeah, that is problematic.
I bet Terry Pratchett didn't have this problem. Tolkien definitely didn't.
No, it's all written down and parchment and ink back in them there are days.
Typewriter. So diaries. Yes. Definitely write them, yes.
Okay,
and it's a dying craft really, and to be fair I have got out of the habit of writing mine.
Mm.
Mainly because I'm trying to write fiction.
Yeah. Because when we are taught to do like tarot or oracle cards, one thing to develop is about keeping a diary of, you know, a particular card you've pulled for the day and how it affects the rest of the day. That's one way of doing it.
That's one way to improve your belief.
Mm.
You know, obviously you'd have to believe in it a little bit to be doing the tarots.
Yeah.
But then if you prove that you're right every few days by going, yeah, I drew this card and this happened, it would help you reinforce it and probably help your skill, I'd imagine. You know, it'd be like flexing that writing muscle. You'd be flexing the tarot muscle.
Intuitive, yeah, muscle.
That muscle, yes. Yeah.
I feel like you're telling me I should do this as well.
I'm not telling you anything. I don't know that much on that. Probably any faith, actually, it would help.
Yeah.
You know? I had this miracle happen to me today. Well, that proves that my religion is right, or whatever. However you want to look at it.
Yeah. And you've had what you call like mini miracles happening in your life as well. And you actually did stand up in a church event, didn't you?
On my baptism and said it, yeah. I mean, the main miracle was I asked for help in with a major issue, and the answer so I asked for it was better than I had actually asked for.
Yeah.
Life-changingly different, in fact.
But it is the little things as well, isn't it?
So write down in your diary all those little blessings you have. You know? You have a child. You have a wife or a husband. You have a house. You have some health.
Yeah.
And somebody might be ill, but, you know, we have not quite a spiritual miracle. We have the NHS in this country.
Mm.
You know, people are very lucky. People don't know how lucky they are. And there are some people that are on the streets that are very unlucky. But maybe there are some miracles that they can draw from.
Yeah.
There is maybe some support. I don't know much about that stuff. But, you know, maybe they've got their health, maybe the fact that they've got some good memories. Maybe they can try again in life. So try and be grateful for all the miracles you do have in life.
That's lovely, really lovely advice there. Yeah, I feel a lot of our listeners will really kind of draw a lot of inspiration from your words on that front. But yeah, keeping things like a gratitude journal as well, or diary, as we call it over here in Blighty. You know, little things like that. And being grateful for stuff that's outside of us as well is another thing that kind of is very important to myself. Noticing little miracles, like, for example, and I always use this one, how nature bursts through concrete and kind of claims things back, you know.
If you want a miracle, go for a walk in the countryside.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're 5 minutes away from the countryside where we are. A walk up there, you see all the blossom coming out on the trees, you see rabbits, you see the sheep in the field. How much of a miracle is that? Yeah. All the grass, the sky, okay, blue sky, although right now it's grey. Welcome to England.
Yes. We're just right outside of Dartmoor, so it's, you know, a lot of seasons in 5 minutes usually.
But, you know, even if you live in the city, there's normally a nice-ish park nearby. Or you can walk to a river. And after you clamber over the shopping trolleys, you see how wonderful it is.
Yeah, exactly. And how, you know, nature has reclaimed itself from... I know it's not a good thing to, you know, kind of fly tip and dump your rubbish around, but nature has a way of fighting back, which is a miracle in itself.
Remember, if you wake up, that's a miracle. There's plenty of people that don't.
Yeah, very true, very true. Yeah, fantastic. I love that. Nice bit of spiritual insight there from Alan. So lovely.
Your job's in the threat now.
It is. But then I don't feel that way. You know, about other people kind of coming in. I like to develop them as well. It's like my calling, if you like. Okay. I think that we're kind of coming towards the end of our time together. Unless you've got anything else that you've kind of remembered that you want to add at all.
Nothing I can think of.
Okay, right, well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Good to be on the show.
Just having a little handshake there for everybody that can't see. And amazing. Thank you so much. And we're going to sign off now. So we will speak to you all again very soon. Thank you for listening.
Goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.